Where else can you choose from over 300 miles of epic single track against a backdrop of soaring mountains and cascading waterfalls? And where else can you explore 100,000 acres of public lands laced with hundreds of miles of backcountry gravel roads? Your best mountain biking adventure ever begins in Brevard, North Carolina, home to Pisgah National Forest and DuPont State Recreational Forest. Four primo bike shops will get you sorted, whether you need a rental, service, or some cool swag. Top it off with an array of craft breweries, cafes, and gathering spots that have earned Brevard the title as one of America's coolest small towns. It all adds up to one of the premier mountain biking destinations in the U.S. Find out more at explorebrevard.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Sean Leader. Sean is the founder of Wind Rock Bike Park and Southern Gravity, a Tennessee-based company that builds ramps and shuttle vehicles for bike parks. Not only that, Southern Gravity recently released a prototype steel downhill mountain bike that's being tested by top elite and junior downhill riders. Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
So you've obviously worn a lot of different hats in the mountain bike world. What was kind of the moment you realized you could make a living in the sport?
I've been just like an avid outdoor athlete my whole life. I've kind of tapped into a lot of different stuff, rock climbing, kayaking, skiing. I ride a lot of motorcycles and I've always mountain biked. It's always been my favorite thing to do.
Okay.
But I was racing for a long time, and I started building trails here in Tennessee because it was kind of a necessity. We didn't have a ton of places to train, and I was also seeing a lot of innovation when I'd go travel places like big jump trails and flow trails, and that just was not here. So I started renting excavators and building trails in my backyard, and and that just kind of led into the trail building thing. I wasn't really seeking it out. I just was kind of doing it out of necessity, and now it's turned into a bit of a job.
Yeah, that's really cool. And yeah, to be clear, like, what part of Tennessee are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm in East Tennessee, so I'm just outside of Knoxville.
Okay.
And it's a good town here. Like, we're in a good set of mountains. Like, Knoxville sits in a valley between Appalachia and the Cumberland Mountains. So on either side of us, we have like a really good mountain range.
Yeah.
And they both have different characteristics.
Yeah. And was there like, I mean, it sounds like maybe there wasn't a lot of trail available at all, right? Or were there, or is there like national forests or stuff like that around you? Or is it pretty?
The national parks, you can't really ride in them. They're, Smoky Mountain National Park has always been like low impact hiking only.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have a good few places that were just like hand built single track.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where I grew up riding, was just like these hand-built spots that were volunteer-built. And really, they're really good trails. And they're trails I still ride today, like, and they haven't changed much. And I do some work at those places now to, like, bring them back to life. But we definitely had a good community of volunteers and trail builders that have stayed in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool to see.
Yeah. And so was the stuff that you were building though, like, different from that? I mean, yeah, it sounds like you're saying there were natural trails that kind of already existed, but you were maybe looking for something a little different.
Yeah. I don't think the introduction of bringing machines into trail building had made its way here. So I was kind of on the front end of that. There was a couple of us that had been traveling and seen what was going on in these other communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the change of bringing machines into the equation. And I mean, we had amazing downhill tracks at Windrock far before I was riding, you know, and great hand-built stuff. And there's plenty of opportunity there. But the introduction of bringing excavators into trail building, it hadn't really been done here in town.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have heard of Windrock. Tell us kind of how that got started. I mean, it sounds like people were riding there before, but you essentially established the official bike park there. Is that how it went?
Yeah. Windrock's had a long history in downhill, and it really had its peak in when Norba Nationals were very popular.
Okay.
And there was a dedicated group of guys that were building downhill tracks there and using them to train. Some of them even racing World Cups.
Mm-hmm.
So it had its highs and lows, though. Mm. I think it really had a big peak in like 2003, 2004. And then after 2008 and, you know, as the economy went into a recession, I think we had a really low spot for Windrock and the trails started to disappear. The amount of volunteers that were out there was dwindling. I think a lot of the original builders had recently had children, so their lives kind of shifted a little bit.
Yeah.
And so it went into a lull, and it had quite a lot of years where the forest was just taking it back. But there was one or two people that were keeping it alive, and that got me into it. And myself and Nico, we started training there. We were racing and using Windrock as a good place to test equipment and go racing. And the two of us just started riding together more and more. And we started a race series, Downhill Southeast. It was really Nico's series, but I was willing to come and volunteer and do whatever needed to happen to like make it work. And that led us to Windrock to host an event. And after we hosted that event, the landowners said, hey, how can we make this like more established? And we put together a business plan and hit the ground running. And we started the park with adding in like one big flow trail. And then we revitalized like 10 trails that had been like re-earthed.
Okay.
And yeah, started building shuttle equipment and slowly refined that over the years. But it was really just right place at the right time type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for those who don't know too, like Windrock had been this like off-road, I mean, I guess it still is more like motorized stuff, but now the bike park is like distinctly separate from that. Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah. Right about the time we were building the bike park, the off-road park had started to grow, and the landowners saw an opportunity to invest in campgrounds and cabins. And so we kind of developed the two parks simultaneously.
Okay.
It was a piece of land that was used for natural resources. They were mining, wind energy, logging, and recreation was just kind of a small side of their business plan. And over the years that grew, and it's now like one of the biggest off-road parks in the country. I mean, you don't meet people that are in the off-road world that don't know about it.
Yeah.
So it's really a unique place. I mean, it's a massive piece of property. They say it's the biggest privately owned off-road park in the nation.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Looking at the map, it's like, it's pretty incredible. And I guess that makes sense, 'cause you're like, you're driving a vehicle, so you can, I imagine you can get pretty far back there. How much of the park though is like bike park versus off-road vehicle?
Yeah, maybe like a hundredth of it. It's I don't know.
Wow.
Whatever the math is, I think it's around 80,000 acres they own, and the bike park sits on about 300 acres of it.
Wow.
So it's massive, and we ride a lot of hard enduro style motorcycles out there. And you can't cover the property in one day. You know, we kind of have five different zones that we'll go to, and we'll drive to each of those different zones, because it's not realistic to ride a motorcycle across the whole piece of property.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, you recently passed the bike park on to Aaron Gwynn. What were some of the challenges you faced as a bike park operator? Like, was it all like fun, or were there things that you're like, I'm kind of tired of doing this?
Yeah, no, it had its ups and downs. I mean, as an overall, yeah, it was fun. It was an amazing experience. I think the biggest struggles were really like self-induced. You know, when you invite 1,000 people to come ride your mountain, it's going to raise the stress level, right? So
yeah,
when we would host big events, it would raise the stress level, but I think that's pretty self-induced.
Yeah. I've heard, if it's any consolation, like everybody I talk to, because I recently did a trip to Windrock and some other bike parks in the area, but everybody said like, wow, the events that they run at Windrock, like these bike events are some of the best. I mean, like everything starts on time, like everything seems really well organized. So
yeah.
I mean, I guess that hard work definitely paid off.
I definitely took a lot of pride in that. I think I've been to events that are run poorly, and it was really important to me to like absolutely do the best I could. So I would pour everything into those, like just so many late nights and early mornings. And just like, there was never a time that I was willing to like sacrifice the quality of the event for like my own enjoyment. So I would lay it all out for those. And, and I do think it paid off. I think it set a precedence for downhill racing that has revitalized the sport. I mean, I think it was in a low spot when we started, and I think the quality of events that we were putting on really set the bar high. And now downhill racing, I think, is better for it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so I mentioned in the intro that you recently came out with a downhill mountain bike, a prototype bike. Why build your own downhill bike?
Yeah, I kind of the same thing as trail building. Like I saw necessity for something we needed in our community. So I got into running excavators and building trails. And in the last 3 years, through the shift of pandemic and supply chain, I've just noticed that companies had to refocus on the things that are selling the best for them. And that's not downhill bikes for most companies. So most of our big brands in the US seem to just push downhill bikes on the back burner. I mean, we have a rental fleet of maybe 20, 30 downhill bikes, and we turn that fleet over normally every 8 months to a year. And during that time period, we couldn't turn the bikes over. We ran the same downhill bikes for 2.5 years, not because I wanted to, but because the supply was gone. I mean, there was, there was no ability to buy bikes from any of the US brands. And then the bigger shift that I was seeing was there was a time when a bike park could buy, say, a Specialized demo that had a low end build on it, and you could buy them for your bike park as rental bikes for $1,800. And at the start of the pandemic, that was cut off across the board. I mean, I called probably 15 different companies saying, "Hey, I need rental bikes." And the only thing that was available was buying downhill bikes that had like the full race build, the nicest build out there.
You don't want that for a rental.
It doesn't make sense. It's not, it's not financially reasonable. So, I mean, we had a hard time sourcing bikes through those years, and it was getting frustrating because I felt like the companies that were benefiting from the big events that I was hosting weren't giving it back to us, you know, weren't thinking about us and supporting the downhill community. So, I mean, I think these are kind of the same reasons why we saw Nico build his bikes. And when Nico got into his Frameworks project, I was one of the first people he told about it. And, you know, he asked me, he brought me the drawings and said, "Hey, what do you think about these? Can you make some of these parts for me?" And I grew up in a family that does manufacturing. My family owns CNC shops and they build and manufacture industrial equipment.
Okay.
So I have a backing in it, and that's really what got me going in it. So I looked at Nico's drawings, and they were something that our shop really couldn't focus on. That's a lot of small aluminum machining, and our facility does a lot of like bigger steel machining. And so we didn't quite have the tooling and the equipment that was necessary to produce what he was after. But through the process, you know, we talk all the time, and it was really cool to see him go from his first prototype to where he is now. And I think, you know, it was a light bulb moment of saying, "Listen, we can do this ourselves. If we don't have the support we need for these bikes, we can create them ourselves." And so right now, I mean, I'm in a stage where I'm just prototyping things. I'm seeing if this is realistic. Like, can I actually produce enough of these in a year to make a difference? And are they going to be good enough to actually want to sell them to somebody? I mean, to me, it's like the same thing as my events. Like I want to make sure that I can produce a quality piece of equipment that's something that I feel good about selling to people. So if that takes a year, 2 years, 3 years to develop that product, I'm willing to do that. But I think for now, I'm just exploring and experimenting with some ideas and seeing where it takes us.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, so you mentioned that there are like fewer downhill bikes, and a lot of the brands are like not focusing on that as a category. Do you think is part of that because like riders have shifted to enduro bikes for like bike park stuff, or is it something else?
I think there's a shift. I mean, obviously, I think the biggest sold bikes are probably in the 130, 140 mil range.
Yeah.
Just because that's the more accessible trails. Mm-hmm. So as we see a shift in new bike parks opening, I think that the demand for the downhill bike is improving and like coming back. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I get it. If you're a big company and you need to allocate resources to the things that make the most money. I mean, if you're selling downhill bikes, even as Trek or Specialized, like if you look at how many downhill bikes they're bringing into the US every year, it's such a small number that mm-hmm. I can understand why you wouldn't care. I mean, maybe 100. I mean, I think at one point I had heard that Trek was bringing in 100 downhill bikes for a 2-year period.
Wow.
I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but
I mean, it seems reasonable, right? Yeah. I mean,
right.
Like I said, most consumers don't have them. Obviously, if you're racing downhill, you need a downhill bike. But yeah, for a lot of people, I think, yeah, an enduro bike's probably enough for them.
Totally. So yeah I mean, it makes sense from a business standpoint. I get it. But it also, it leaves an opening for small business owners to move into that niche. And that's really was the philosophy of Windrock too, is like, I never thought that Windrock was going to compete with big corporate resorts building massive flow trails. That just wasn't my business model. Mm-hmm. I believed in the sport of racing downhill, and I felt like there was a big enough customer base there to support a facility that was focusing on that. Mm-hmm. And it was. I mean, I think that it was, Windrock was very successful at the end of it, and it supported itself in a way that I anticipated.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a hole in the market there for, if you can just hyper focus on this niche and provide really high quality product for a certain small amount of people, mm-hmm. you don't need more customers. You just need customers who appreciate what you're doing for them and support you.
Yeah. How many of these prototype bikes have you made so far?
I'm on my fifth one now.
Okay.
So this batch, we did 3 in this batch, and I had a couple before that were kind of leading up to it. But this batch, I made 3, and I made an extra small, a medium, and a large, with the intent of bringing 3 riders onto them to help me test them. I get to ride a lot, like more than most people, but you need a lot of hours to log on these things, I think, to really be able to tell the durability of them. Mm-hmm. So I brought on 3 kids that I thought had a ton of potential here in the Southeast. Mm-hmm. An elite rider, Jack Peterson, who did really good last year. It was just his second season racing downhill, and he won the downhill Southeast overall last year.
Wow.
So I saw a ton of potential in him. And last year I was supporting him some, like I gave him a bike and some extra sets of wheels and stuff just to help him through the season, mm-hmm. with no commitment. I mean, I just said, here's a Cummins, I'll ride this thing, like enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So I liked helping him last year. It was a good relationship. So this year he stayed on. And then I added a junior who last year raced 15, 16 category in downhill Southeast, and he won the overall. And this year he'll be racing 17, 18.
Okay.
And I think he has good potential to try and push for that overall as well. It's hard when you're a 17 in that bracket.
Mm, yeah.
But his name's Charlie Goldwyn, and he's just like one of the most dedicated kids I've worked with and just so hungry for it. Mm. So I'm excited to see how he does this year. And then our youngest kid, Bryson Presson, is a local, and he's really been a product of Windrock. I mean, he started riding there when he was, I think, maybe 9 or 10.
Wow.
And he's just such a shredder. Like you see viral videos of him all the time, 'cause he throws these huge fat whips and like, he's so small.
Yeah.
But I wanted to focus on building extra small bikes. I've seen over the last few years that there's really no bikes that fit these kids properly, other than the Cummins started making an extra small bike, which I thought was really cool of them to dedicate some time into that.
Yeah.
And so I felt like that was important to me. It was like, if I'm going to do this, I need to appeal to some of the smaller riders and the people that are having the hardest time finding bikes.
Mm. Yeah.
So Bryson's going to be racing 15, 16 this year. And I'm hoping that all 3 of them can win some championships. I mean, I think they all have the potential, and they're all on my training schedule now. I'm doing their coaching for them. And I think that having that whole package is really like going to gonna get these kids to where they can be.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I actually met, I think it was Charlie and Bryson out at Windrock a couple weeks ago, and they were riding the bikes, and you know, I asked them a little bit about the bikes. Like, they were very stoked with them, but I totally get what you're saying too about logging lots of hours on the bikes, because these kids, like, they, you know, they'd get on the shuttle, they'd beat the shuttle down to the bottom, and they'd be ready for like the next lap. And like, they were just, you know, it was like a nasty day too, and these kids did not care. Like, they must have gotten in 20 laps at least. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's 3 days a week too. And I mean, yeah, when I go out and ride now, like if I can do 8-10 laps, I'm happy with that. And that's about all my body wants. And yeah, they'll literally do 20 laps in the rain and not think twice about it. So you need that. You need to log a ton of hours. And I think it's important to have different kids riding them and seeing how they maintain the bike versus me. Like, I'm probably going to check my spoke tension and bolt check my bike every few laps, and they might not, you know? And I think that's an important part to the testing process, to see it when they're saying, hey, this bolt's coming loose, because they're not checking it as avidly as I would. I think that's an important part to be able to see, like, what's going to come loose, what's going to make noise.
Yeah, they definitely are going to abuse those bikes. Yeah, it was pretty clear from just, yeah, the conditions there. And yeah, it's tough conditions, and they're tough riders. And yeah, if anybody's going to find fault with the bike like that, it's going to be those guys.
Yep.
So you mentioned choosing to do these bikes in steel, I guess partly because of your expertise, and also you maybe had some equipment. Like, but are there other advantages of like a steel downhill bike frame compared to maybe other materials that people are using?
From what I've seen so far, yes, there is significant advantages. The first steel bike I rode was Canfield Brothers. Canfield was making phenomenal bikes for a long time. The Jedi was one of the best downhill bikes I've rode. It was heavy as can be. Like, it was the heaviest downhill bike I've ever rode, but one of the best performing ones.
So heavier is better? Is that what you're saying? Or is it because it was steel?
Well, I think there's a point where the weight is good. Mm-hmm. But that one was on the heavy side. It was on the too heavy side.
Okay.
But I will say I rode it for a year. It never had an issue. I never broke the frame. I never, you know, it was a great ride. Like, it was comfortable to ride it. It was a really, really good bike.
Yeah.
And since that time, like, I think around 2016, 2017 was the last time I had a bike sponsor. Mm-hmm. I had sponsored bikes for probably 8 years before that, and I just kind of rode what was given to me. Mm-hmm. And since 2016, I haven't taken a bike sponsor, which has allowed me to ride like tons of different frames. And so I'll buy a new frame every 3 months and swap all my parts over to it and ride a new frame just for the sake of seeing what's out there and, mm-hmm. and what rides well. And I've broken tons of frames. I mean, just you name it, I've broken that frame. And from alloy to carbon bikes, they crack or they shatter. Mm-hmm. You hit them on something, they break immediately. So to me, I think steel is durability, but also ride comfort. And the feel of a steel bike is different. Like, you can ride an alloy and a steel bike back to back, and it's a noticeable difference. They dampen the ground a little bit better.
Yeah.
They feel better on your hands. They don't feel as harsh. So I think they have advantages that are appealing to me. I think if you are a young rider and you can't replace your bike multiple times during the season, durability is a big factor, I think.
Yeah.
And so I just feel like durability is huge. I also think that the process of building and working with steel is more appealing to me. It's a nicer material to work with. It's more forgiving. It's more realistic to build it in the US, and that was important to me. So I think there's a lot of ways to go about it. If you're building a World Cup performance bike and you can go through 10 of them in a season, sure, maybe the carbon option is the best way to go. But I want a product that is going to last people a long time and can be fixed. I mean, you can have a weld crack on a steel bike and you can fix it. You can re-weld it and it's fine. It's not an issue.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, obviously people have said this, you know, steel has the same advantages over like aluminum and carbon for things like gravel, you know, hard tails. It's noticeable. I'm kind of surprised, but not surprised that you're saying you can feel that difference on a downhill bike, like surprised because obviously you have a lot more suspension and things to like soak up the trail chatter, but I guess not surprised because downhill athletes, like you're very tuned to the bike and how it feels and handles. So yeah, is that kind of where you can feel it? Or yeah, how are you feeling that through the suspension?
Yeah, I feel like suspension's so dialed these days. Like you can tune it so good that, and just the whole bike in general, like mm-hmm. if you're logging a ton of laps, you can feel that the smallest things once you're really tuned in to mm-hmm. how the bike's going to react. And from the small bump compliance to like the really, really big compressions, you feel it in both of them. You can feel it absorbing the bumps more. I mean, it's even audible. Like you can hear the difference.
Oh, wow.
Where they're quieter. They dampen the sound more. So it's like a quieter ride as well. Like you can hear the difference in them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, like the small bump vibration, it sucks a lot of that into the frame and you don't feel it in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think across the board, it's very noticeable.
Yeah. I think the other thing that, you know, people like me, like I've barely ridden downhill, let alone raced it. Like for a lot of us, I guess we imagine like you're running similar tire pressures and like suspension pressures, but on a downhill race bike, like what is like the tire pressure that somebody would be running, like a pro would be running on a bike?
Yeah. I mean, it's always a balance of like trying to get it low enough that there's good traction, but mm-hmm. firm enough that you're not breaking wheels.
Yeah.
And it's a mix of what people are using right now. I mean, some people are a big fan of using a cush core or some kind of tire insert that's helping. And that allows you to get your pressures a little bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say most guys are running like between 28 and 32 PSI in the rear tire and like okay. between 24 and 27 in the front.
Okay. So yeah, that's not crazy high. I mean, I think, yeah, a lot of people are running that. But the suspension is definitely like, I would guess, more firm because you're hitting it much harder.
Yeah. And suspension has just developed so much over the years. Like the shocks that we were riding, even in 2016, a shock that we were riding in 2016 to now,
mm-hmm.
They're so much better. And I think a lot of bike design in 2016 was they were tuning the kinematics to accommodate the shocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would see, like when I go back and study the kinematic profiles of bikes from 2015 to 2017, I think a lot was being done to accommodate for the quality of the shock. And now the shocks have gotten so much better that I think it opens the doors to tuning the kinematics of the bike in a different way, where the shock can do a lot of the work that before you were having to do that in the way your linkage was designed. Whereas now I think you can rely on the shocks more and you can develop your kinematics to be a little different than they were before.
Yeah. Well, speaking of kinematics, you know, we wrote back in September about the DW Link patent expiration. So just expired in late last year. And it looks like you're using something similar to DW Link or it's DW Link inspired. Did the expiration of that patent figure into your design plans at all? Were you thinking about that?
I was thinking about it. And you read all these things online about the controversy between Giants, Maestro Link and DW Link. And
yeah,
I don't really know what went on there. It's all speculation. And I downloaded the patents on DW Link and kind of studied them. And I'm not an engineer by any means. And so I was doing the best to do my background research on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with the style Link that we're using because I felt like the Giant Glory was one of the better riding bikes I had rode. And mm-hmm. also, more importantly, though, is that I think when you build a steel rear end, it's very important that the swing arm be one piece. So with a four bar system, right, you're going to have a bearing that's at the chain stay or the seat stay. So you're going to have the seat stay is going to be one piece. The chain stay is going to be one piece. And I think what I had seen in the past of steel manufacturers or even friends who built steel bikes, steel downhill bikes that had a bearing at the chain stay or seat stay, it created a lot of flex in the material and the rear end felt like a noodle, like it just wallered around and couldn't track the ground.
Yeah.
So you break it down on what bikes are out there that have a one piece swing arm. If that's your goal, you say, all right, I want to use a steel frame. I need it to be a one piece swing arm. What's out there that's doing that right now? And there's some single pivot options out there. And then you get into double link setups. And I knew I was experienced with the Giant. I felt like it was one of the better bikes. And so I started on that platform. And the first steel bike I built, I actually took a 2016 Giant Glory that I had sitting in my garage, like an old frame that never sold. And I took the rear end off of it. I took the linkages off of it, laid it out on a piece of paper and started making some sketches, and then jumped on the computer and said, hey, can I use this aluminum rear end and these links, build a steel front end that has current geometry? And go from there. So the first prototype I made was using the rear end off a Giant Glory. And then I just got on there. There's this really amazing program out there called Linkage. I'm sure a lot of people know about it, but some don't. It's, it's very inexpensive, like $30 for license to use it. And it has a database that's user uploaded. And so you can study so many bikes that have been made. You can study how their kinematics work in this program. If you ever want to get a better understanding of how your bike works, download Linkage. I'm sure the bike that you ride is probably on there and you can study the kinematics. So that's where I started. And I was just basically looking through every single bike that was in the database and seeing how their linkage actually worked and what that would equate to in leverage ratio, wheel path, any squat, any rise. And you can even layer multiple bikes on top of each other. So you can stack three bikes on top of each other and see the difference of them. And so I think that's the starting point for anybody that wants to better understand how their suspension platform's working. And so I started there. I had a Glory in my garage. I had Glory on Linkage. And then, so then you go to, you know, how can I make the front triangle? Because, you know, your kinematics is based on where all of the XY coordinates are of all your points, right? So if you make a front triangle and you use a rear triangle from somebody else's bike, you do have the opportunity to move the XY coordinates of where those linkages meet on the front triangle and where your bottom bracket height is. And that's making a huge difference, right? So you have three points of variation that you can utilize to take somebody else's design and modify it if you're going to go this route. So I was able to change the kinematics of a 2016 Glory to have a leverage ratio that I felt was more in line with today's standards and have the geometry that was more in line with today's standards. And while I was doing this, I obviously had in the back of my head, like, okay, if I can do this, I can make the full bike, but let me just prove it by skipping the steps of having the linkages designed and machined. That bike rode great. I got it built up and it rides so good. And so that was for sure like the point where I was like, all right, I think I can actually do this. And yeah, from there I started thinking about how I was going to manufacture the linkages and the rear end. And I was going back and forth with Nico. Nico's helped me through this whole process, which has been awesome. Like,
yeah, that's cool.
So I would send him my linkage file and say, what do you think of this? And a day later, he'd be like, ah, take a look at this. And I'd be like, okay, that's cool. And we kind of went back and forth like that on a few times. And he must have been bored at some point because he hit me up with this email and he's like, all right, I've been staring at this for 5 nights. And I think if you move this shock to being non-concentric with the link point, you can tune this, you can tune this so much better. So that really opened a new thought that I hadn't seen yet. And from there we were able to tune it to like just where I thought would be pretty good for the setup. So Yeah, it's been a interesting process. Like I said, I'm pretty new to this, but I think that there is amazing resources out there, and there's awesome YouTube videos that are people who are just diehards and fanatics about this. Mm-hmm. So I'm really going on what I know about manufacturing and what's realistic, and then kind of learning along the way, but also relying on some friends who have a little bit more experience than me.
Yeah.
But I think we've come a long way with bikes, and there's so much information out there. And when you can study what people have been doing for the last 20 years, you can wrap your head around it pretty quick. You know, I think people have put in the legwork, and now it's a little bit easier to learn from the mistakes that other people have made. So
yeah,
that's been enjoyable.
Yeah. Cool. How long did it take you from, like, you know, this idea, I want to design a bike, to the prototypes now where you have your own linkage and everything is your build?
Yeah. It's been a little over a year now.
Okay.
Probably coming closer to 2 years now. And it really sparked, like, I had a friend who reached out to me who was moving here from Vegas, and he was building steel bikes. He has a small business called Ferrum. Hmm. And he hit me up and said, "Hey, I'm moving to Knoxville. I need a place to stay just for a month." And so I let him come stay in our cabin on our farm, and he brought his jig with him and his little TIG welder, and he had it sitting in the barn. And I was like, it kind of was stars aligning, where I was like, I was already interested in this process, and I was like pushing him to see if we could make a downhill bike together. And so it helped to have him on board and help show me how to set the jig up, and he's welded all the bikes now.
Okay.
Which has been great. Like, I did the welding on the first one I built just cause I really wanted to learn it, and it looked fine. I've been welding my whole life and was able to adapt pretty quick, but he's been welding the frames for me. He's a great welder, and he's really good in the machine shop and stuff. So
yeah,
he's been helping along the way.
Cool.
So yeah, it's been about 2 years.
Okay, nice. So assuming, you know, everything goes well with the prototypes, what's like the next step? Like, I mean, I would guess it sounds like maybe you see an opportunity for like bike park bikes, like having these as like rental bikes potentially, or like, yeah, what are you looking at?
Yeah, I think, my business, Southern Gravity, it focuses on supplying bike parks with the things they need. Mm. So we have worked hard on refining and developing the shuttle trailers and the trucks as well. Mm. And we're also been building a lot of like ramps and bike skill zone style features. Mm. So for sure, my focus is on supporting bike parks, especially small bike parks that are shuttle access parks. Mm-hmm. And I see this being as a way where we can supply them with the fleets that they need. But it's tough. Like, I think I can't remember who was telling me like that rental bikes are a dangerous one to get into, because I think it was maybe Kona who like supplied Whistler with like hundreds of rental bikes, and they would treat them like crap. And then it was maybe not a good brand image to have a bunch of really clapped out bikes.
Yeah. You're like, I rode one of those at Whistler and it wasn't very good. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of tough. Like, I feel like if I'm going to go down that road, it's going to have to be at parks that I know the owners and have a good relationship with them, where I know that they will see these bikes more as short term, like don't own them for 5 years, keep them running fresh. So it's kind of tough to like want to only focus on that. But I think to me, an end goal would be going to Winrock and seeing half the bikes on that shuttle trailer are either ones that I've produced or ones that Nico's produced. It's frustrating when you go out to the park and you see the majority of the bikes going up are from Commensal, YT, Canyon. Mm. And I appreciate what those guys are doing. I think that it's great that they're so invested in downhill, but it's hard for me to understand why US manufacturing has just completely disappeared. Mm. And especially for things like frames. I mean, I think that frames are something that we can be making here in the United States. I mean, they're...
Yeah.
making a frame isn't as detailed as making suspension, right? Like, I get it if we need to build suspension and have all those tiny little parts machined in Asian countries, but.
Or Cane Creek. I mean, Cane Creek, they're doing a lot, as far as I know, doing a lot yes. in the US. So yep. yeah, even that, yeah. that's
and
possible.
Industry 9.
Yeah.
It is possible. It is totally possible. So I'm a big believer in US manufacturing, and I hope to get all the parts for these things eventually machined in the United States. Hmm. And I don't see this being, I'm not going to drop everything else I'm doing and just focus on this. Like, but it's right now it's just kind of a passion project. And if people like the bikes and want the bikes, I'll make them. Hmm. So I don't have to do it. I'm not relying on it. I just want to explore it for fun and see if other people enjoy it. Maybe I'll dive into it deeper, you know?
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense what you said that, yeah, Southern Gravity is about supplying bike parks with the things that they need. Is the bike park, like, is that a growing business? Like, are there more of these? I mean, I know here in the Southeast, there's like three or four bike parks that have opened just in the last few years. Is that happening elsewhere in the country, or like, what do you see that market doing in the next few years?
Yeah, I foresee it happening across the whole country. And obviously I know about a few more that are going to open in the next year or 2 years.
Oh, cool.
And I'm working on the back end on a couple of those myself. Mm-hmm. So I can say that we have shuttle trucks and trailers on order right now. I have something like 10 trucks and trailers on order for different parks.
Wow.
So I see these things opening across the country, and it's cool to see. I seem to recall on a podcast maybe 4 or 5 years ago talking about Windrock, saying, I hope one day that these things are in every single town. Uh-huh. And I still stand behind that. I think that if every community can support having 10, 15 soccer fields, football fields, I think every community can support having a bike park. And it might not be an international destination that is hosting UCI events. It might just be 300 foot of elevation that is built for your local community. So I see these things popping up all over the East Coast, and hopefully across the country. I think that the business model works, and it can employ 10 or 15 people that are wanting to be in the bike industry. So I hope to see more of them. And I think we will. I know of a few that are going to open this year that I'm excited about.
Yeah, it seems like the Southeast in particular is a good area for it, just because of like the weather and lots of land generally available, you know. And we recently did this like mini bike park tour in the Southeast and saw your shuttle vehicles at Rock Creek, at Windrock, and also at Jared's place. And yeah, I mean, it's like, once you see it, you're like, oh, wow, this is like such a great system. And at Rock Creek, I think they were saying that the shuttle vehicle, you know, can actually get you to the top of the run faster than a lift could, just because, you guys have
absolutely
really dialed in kind of the setup. And I was imagining, I guess, even just a few years ago, people were using like school buses or something, right? And this system of these like kind of open air vehicles with benches and then like a trailer hauling bikes, like super efficient. And yeah, it seems like that's a big part of what makes these bike parks work.
Yeah. We went through the list of crappy vehicles that broke down on me. And I learned over those years that owning a bike park, you're in the business of getting people to the top of the mountain. Hmm. And if you can't do that efficiently, you have a poor business model.
Is that like the biggest cost, like in terms of the vehicles, the maintenance and fuel and that sort of thing? Or is it just one of many costs?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's the biggest cost. It just sits right in there with the rest of your average payroll insurance. It's no more expensive than that.
Okay.
And I really advocate for most parks to go ahead and buy brand new vehicles. You know, even if you finance two trucks out of the gate, you're probably spending around $1,000 a month per truck.
Okay.
And the equipment is another cost on top of that. And we offer some options, like if places needed to finance those, we could help them with that. But having good equipment is important. You can't run a bike park without good equipment.
Yeah.
And we do outperform chairlifts. I mean, I think we can outperform at chairlifts 4-1.
Oh, wow.
It's wildly more efficient. It's infinitely cheaper. And it also offers some benefits to like building the community. You know, when you get on a chairlift, you go there by yourself. You might ride the chair with a person or two, right? You don't meet all these people.
That's right. Cause the way the benches are set up too, like, should tell people who haven't seen these, like you're facing each other. There's like one bench facing forward, one facing backward. And so, those conversations, they happen.
Yeah. You meet people from all over the place. And I mean, it's a great way to build community. And then there's benefits as well with, knowing where people are on the mountain. It's one of the biggest things that's frustrating on a chairlift park is you have a constant stream of people. So this works in both directions for both people who are very fast and people who are very slow, is that you're either running people down constantly, you're constantly catching people, or you're constantly having people come up behind you and run you off the trail. So it works in both directions. And when you use a truck system, if you want to get down the mountain quick, you get off that truck and you hustle to the start of the trail and you go down and don't stop and you won't see anybody. And you'll also see people getting to the top and kind of waiting and making sure that they're the last person to go down because they don't want to get caught.
That's me.
Exactly. And so there's good advantages to it. I mean, I think bike parks were retrofitted to make ski resorts money in the summer. And if we rethink that business model to bike parks are here to build communities and economies of people who enjoy mountain biking, we can restructure how we think about the business operation and focus on just what's important to us. So I think there's room for bike parks in every town, and you put a shuttle trail up somewhere, people are going to ride it, man. Whether it's a 1 minute shuttle or a 10 minute shuttle, if somebody has the opportunity to not pedal up a hill, they're going to take it.
I mean, speaking of mountain bike towns, you know, you mentioned folks moving to Knoxville, and Windrock is Knoxville area, is where you're based. I mean, do you see Knoxville in particular becoming sort of a hub in this like gravity scene, like not just Southeast, but like nationwide?
I think it's happened. I definitely think it's happened. I mean, it was, I know when I was younger, I thought that Chattanooga was the spot in Tennessee that like all the outdoor athletes were moving to.
Yeah.
And I never really saw it
too.
It is. It's an amazing spot. Like one of my favorite places in the country, really. And I spend a lot of time down in that area still. And I never saw Knoxville as like the outdoor hub of the area. And it really just happened from the work that we put in at Windrock and the work that the Appalachian Mountain Bike Club, the AMBC, they put in South Knoxville. And I think those two forces working simultaneously together, it just created this hub. And we're seeing now, I mean, people are moving here from everywhere and they're buying houses in the area. Some people are buying houses. Like, I would have never guessed that people were going to move to Oliver Springs, buy houses in Oliver Springs. If you're not from this area, just imagine the smallest podunk town that's near you. And that's Oliver Springs. Right. There's one gas station, one Mexican restaurant, and that's it. You know?
Yeah.
I never imagined that somebody would move here from California to live in Oliver Springs, and, and they're doing it. And so it's changing that community, and, it's cool to see. And I hope that everybody who does move here, like, appreciates our Southeastern, vibes that we have. I mean, I think it's, this area is just known for good hospitality and, caring, generous people. And hopefully, the people that come here can adapt and enjoy that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, do you think there's anything in particular about the terrain or the weather or anything that makes Eastern Tennessee a better spot than other places in the country? Or is it on par? Like, what do you think about the terrain in terms of how it compares to other places?
I definitely, I don't know. When you travel across the country, like I'm so envious of the Pacific Northwest because their dirt, I think, is better than us, right? Like you go to Washington and ride in Bellingham or something, and the dirt is amazing. Or in Aptos in California, like I feel like their dirt is better than ours, you know? So it's always like grass is greener on the other side type of situation. Like I think everywhere I go, I can see, oh, this part of that is so amazing. But yeah, here in the Southeast, we do have really steep mountains. They're smaller, but rocky and really steep. And so if you're wanting to race World Cups and you're traveling through Europe, I mean, at this point, the World Cup season is basically a European race series.
Right.
And it just so happens that our mountains are very similar to their mountains. Very similar characteristic. They're rooty, they're rocky, and they're steep. And but the weather is good here through the winter. We'll normally have like a couple weeks where it's cold and might snow one time. But for the most part, it's great weather through the winter. It's not California, 70 degrees and sunny, but
right.
To for us, I mean, 45 degrees is an acceptable temperature to be riding downhill. So if you're willing to ride in 45 to 55 degree weather straight through, you know, January, February, it's great. And then in the summer, honestly, I escape in the summer. Most times it's very hot here.
Like, it is. Yeah.
So July, August is a tough time to be in Tennessee and trying to mountain bike. We normally spend the summer like hanging out on the rivers and the lakes, cause it's really hot. So it's definitely a winter spot, but yeah, I think that's why it panned out so well. Like we were able to host races when no one else was and have training camps when nobody else was. And I think that's the allure to Windrock for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Sean, thanks so much for taking the time to tell us about the gravity scene there in Eastern Tennessee. And yeah, we're really stoked to follow along and see what you're up to next.
Yeah. I appreciate you having me on. Hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Awesome. Well, you can find out more about Sean and his company, Southern Gravity, at southerngravity.com. We'll have that link in the show notes. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.